The Science Inside Podcast. This is the Science Inside.
Dumela moretsi wa rona o montle re ya go amogela mo lenaneong la rona la The Science Inside. Re a itumedisa go nna le wena mo maitseboeng a ke a dumela gore e tlo nna kgatiso e monate e le tota. And that was in Setswana, and basically I was just saying welcome back to The Science Inside. And with that being said, I am your host Bridget Lepere, and I've just welcomed you, and like every other first Monday of a new month, we bring on the show a dazzling scientist who will share with us their remarkable work and the things that they are doing and working on in their specialized field in science. And tonight we are going to be chatting to Colin Saguru, who is a chemical engineer, a research fellow at the University of the Witwatersrand in the Department of Chemical Engineering. And the reason why we are speaking to him tonight is that he has developed an economical, environmentally sustainable and novel method of recovering and reusing precious metals found in autocatalytic converters of petrol and diesel motor vehicles. And this recycling process addresses a number of demands, particularly in the mining industry, where the demand of precious platinum group metals, PGMs in short, is always in high demand, but not always one that can be met. And his alternative solution is profitable, it is environmentally sustainable, as I've said, and saves on the energy and production of producing or extracting these metals. Now, if you don't know what autocatalytic converters are, it has some PGMs in it, and it reduces the toxicity of gases emitted by vehicles through the exhaust pipe. And these PGMs are also known are also on European Union's critical materials list, a list which Collins was determined to exploit, obviously for profit, but for environmental reasons as well. And because, well, the demand also is so high. But before we get into the nitty-gritties of his work, we look at what is interesting and what has been the insightful events that have been taking place in the world of science and in the news. And you can catch us on social media on Facebook as VowFM and tweet us at VowFM, hashtag Science Inside. The podcast is up on iTunes and the vits.journalism.co.za/science. And our WhatsApp line is 084-078-4912. So next up, as you would know, we have the news. So what do you have for us tonight, Masi?
In your news-making headlines, the Department of Science and Technology has pledged 27 million rands to the CPUT's space program. CSIR showcases medicine dispensing robots' capabilities. Good evening, I'm Masibulele Lunika with your Science Inside News. The Department of Science and Technology, DST, has pledged 27 million rands to the Cape Peninsula University of Technology's space program to boost South Africa's space efforts. This was announced recently when DST representatives, CPUT students and local high school learners gathered at the plenary briefing on the status of the country's second nano-satellite called ZyCube-2 on the Bellville campus. The three-year investment is to help CPUT to build three nanosatellites aimed to be launched next year. These will form the basis of a constellation of satellites to provide maritime domain awareness and wildfire detection applications for South Africa and the region. ZyCube 2, worth 16.5 million rands, was successfully launched into space late last year and has started transmitting information to the CPUT ground station. Boneni Moofe, the Deputy Director General of Technology and Innovation at the Department of Science and Technology, said the big aim is to eventually have a constellation of nine satellites, which will be the most advanced in the continent. He elaborates more on the project's aims.
So the idea of having a constellation of satellites, which means more than one, and in this case we're looking at about nine or so. Mm-hmm. That means that at the time when the one satellite has done the Passover, the other one is coming. And when the other one does a Passover, the other one is coming. So ultimately, you end up with a situation where you've got a 24/7 coverage. So that means that you are able to then collect the data that you need 24/7. And this is different from you maybe saying, okay, while you have done your Passover, then whatever you were monitoring, if it, you were trying to look at ships that are entering our waters illegally, by the time when you have passed, the ship can come. So when you've got a constellation, then at least you can pick up things real time. So that's basically the thinking around the additional investment.
And there are a number of benefits being hoped for with the development of this constellation, others being ocean monitoring and veld fire detection.
We use this program to build human capacity. We're building high-quality engineers, and predominantly we're looking at black and women engineers. And we are very pleased that through this program we are achieving that. So that's basically one of the biggest things.
With concerns around possible risks in the investment, the DST is confident that the team will bring good results, as they already proved themselves with the second launch of the ZyCube 2. Monet, a Roman, CPUT's doctoral candidate in electrical engineering and the space program's project manager, elaborates on the technology behind this new satellite.
So CPUT especially has now designed and built two nanosatellites to date, and that is probably, and that is the most by any African university or institution. And what we mean about most advanced satellite is that no other CubeSat in Africa has had an automatic identification system on it, and also a felt fire detection imager on it. So, and it's all packaged into the ZyCube 2, which is a 30 by 10 by 10 centimeter satellite. So it's very small, and it actually does quite a lot for its size.
This satellite is expected to be the most advanced in Africa. Roman says the satellites are due to be completed by September of 2020, although the launch itself may delay more, as the process of launching itself is a lot of work. The Council for Scientific and Industrial Research, CSIR, has collaborated with the Wright ePharmacy to develop a pharmacy automation robot for medicine dispensing. The robot, built by the CSIR and Wright ePharmacy, was displayed at the Intelligent Manufacturing Systems Manuvation 4.0 workshop, which was held at the CSIR campus in Pretoria recently. The robot is automated, is an automated machine that enables people to access their sachet packaged prescribed chronic medication. It will work similar to an automated teller machine or ATM, using robotic technology to label and dispense the medication. Users can either type in their details or allow the machine to read their prescription, which has been issued by their doctor. The machine also requires personal identification to ensure that the medication is being dispensed to the correct patient. Moreover, it has the function to print labels with the patient's medication information and can add this to the sachet before it is dispensed to the patient. AVA34 will mainly be used to dispense chronic medication, where medicines in medicine bags or sachets are supplied to patients. Further, the robot also contains a video call option for users to speak directly to a pharmacist to resolve any queries or provide assistance. The robot was produced locally and constitutes about 80% local materials. It is especially created for those with chronic conditions who require prescribed medication regularly. This model was showcased as a prototype. It will be installed in Alexandra, Johannesburg, where it will serve as the first test model. It can then be installed at hospitals, clinics, pharmacies countrywide, with scope in the future to even export to other countries that use sachet packaging for medication. recapping your top stories this hour, the Department of Science and Technology has pledged 27 million rands to the Cape Peninsula University of Technology space program to boost the country's efforts into space. The three-year investment is to help CPUT to build three nanosatellites aimed to be launched next year around March. The Council for Scientific and Industrial Research has, in partnership with Wright ePharmacy, developed a pharmacy automation robot for medicine dispensing.
Wow, thank you. Thank you so much for the news. Those two stories have been really insightful and interesting. And what is really terrific about this news is that, I mean, these satellites have been built by students, and I think, you know, this this transfer of skills from people who are knowledgeable, who are experts in the field, is growing, developing the skills of these young people, don't you think?
I think so. I agree. And I can tell you that as a CPUT alumni myself, I can't say I'm not proud of where this work is being done. These are some good news, because also late last month, we witnessed a failed rocket launch, actually, at the University of KZN. Interesting.
Are you bringing down the University of KZN?
Actually, it's actually good to hear some good news in light of developments like that. And I was even thinking to myself, if one of them can actually go successfully, how then can institutions of higher learning sort of coordinate to actually share knowledge and skills between each other? Because it's happening in the same country after all.
Well, but I guess then... it's nice to hear this kind of news. Well, anyway, that is all for the news for tonight. Thank you, Masi, for updating us.
Pleasure.
And yeah, that was all from the news desk this evening. Up next, we find out more from Colin Saguru after the break.
You're listening to The Science Inside, bringing you science around major news events.
Welcome back. You're still on The Science Inside. And as mentioned earlier, in studio tonight, we have our feature scientist, Colin Saguru. He's a student here at WITS, and his research looks at reducing mechanical waste by basically using chemical processes to break down certain components where he may actually extract precious metals from discarded car parts. Well, and with that being said, good evening, Collins, and welcome to The Science Inside.
Good evening, Bridget, and thank you for having me.
It's only a pleasure. So I'll just jump right into it, right? We're going to look at more of your professional work. That's where we'll start with our interview. So now your study focuses on recycling catalytic converters from used motor vehicles, and you recover these precious metals, namely platinum, palladium, and rhodium. And by doing so, you're also addressing the global demand for these metals, which have been in short supply for the past couple of 10 years or so. But what is the urgency of this kind of research?
Okay, so... You have rightly put it across. The research was focused on recovering the platinum metals from the catalytic converters. I know it's a bit of a mouthful to say that word. So many people stumble on it. But basically, the catalytic converter is a device that is on the exhaust line of petrol and diesel vehicles. So its purpose is to reduce the toxic emissions, as you put it across earlier, that are produced when you burn petrol and diesel. So the single biggest use for the PGMs is in these catalytic converters, wherein they are reducing the amount of toxic gases that would have been produced had the catalytic converter itself not been developed. So the PGMs play a very important or a critical environmental role, or a critical role in reducing the amount of toxicity that could be in populated areas. Think about the number of vehicles and the amount of petrol and diesel that is burnt in cities like Johannesburg, like Cape Town, like Lagos, you know, those populated African cities, those populated European cities. So the PGMs themselves play a critical role, especially for the people that are within these urban areas. So you would realize that you want to secure supply for such metals for the simple reason that they are very critical in maintaining people's health.
Sure. And I mean, with platinum, I was of the opinion that it wasn't being mined as much because I read somewhere that with you know, industries are changing and they're looking at alternative ways or methods of, you know, of getting their machinery to work. And platinum was just one of those metals that was way too expensive to mine and all of those things. So with I didn't think that, you know, it would still be something that, you know, a metal that they'd still want to look at. But now you've come with this innovation that is looking into this.
Yeah, that's quite true. It would appear as if platinum or the platinum age or the platinum phase is being phased out. But when you look into the developments and the literature and the industrial, you know, research that has been carried out over the past, I could say maybe 15 to 20 years, all scientists and engineers have been trying to find alternatives for these three PGMs, especially for platinum, for the simple reason that you put across that it is an expensive metal. It is one of the precious metals. But the metals themselves have superior properties that no matter how much we have tried or no matter how much scientists have tried to actually make, you know, do research into finding alternatives, it hasn't exactly come to a stage where you can replace them completely industrially. There is a couple of research projects that were conducted under a research grant in the Europe, which is called Horizon 2020. And they developed a couple of, you know, extremely novel, very good catalysts and materials that were supposed to sort of like replace the platinum, but then none of those things could actually come to commercial profitability because of the superior properties that the platinum group metals have got. So it would appear that, especially now with e-vehicles actually coming on board as well, the electronic battery-powered vehicles, it would appear that the age, as some would put it across, of the platinum metals is coming to an end. But it certainly, that would be just be the face value of it. When you get down into the nitty-gritties of the industry, it's not as clear-cut or it's not as straightforward that platinum is not going to be of any use within the next 5, within the next 10, within the next 15 years. So we still have a lot of work. We still have a lot of functions. We still have a lot of uses for the platinum metals, which is why and which is what what inspired my, you know, interest in this particular group of metals. So they're still around. I would want to believe they're still around.
Sure. And let us get into your innovation, right? The novelty of your innovation is that whilst the process to smelt and harvest these three precious metals, because they require a lot of heat, meaning high temperatures, meaning we use up a lot of energy to process this extraction of the metals while heating them up. But now you are able to use chemicals to reduce the heating temperatures by about 1,600 degrees Celsius. What kind of chemicals are we talking about here? Are they, you know, are they good for our health? Are there environmental implications implied here?
Okay, so the current technologies that are being used, like you rightly said, are based on melting the entire catalytic converter, so that you try and recover the PGMs, the three metals, that process typically requires an expensive amount of energy. Like you need a lot of energy, and like you've said, the temperatures that you need to actually melt the entire structures can go to as much as 1700 degrees Celsius. So this is sort of like a pre-treatment step, or a step that is required before you actually do the actual recovery of the metals that you require, or the 3 meters that you need. So what we were trying to do was to develop a process that bypasses this entire step of smelting and goes to direct recovery of the metals. And we managed to do that at a maximum temperature of just 100 degrees Celsius. Now, obviously, that is going to come with a lot of energy savings, because you've, you know, bypassed that particular smelting step. But it doesn't, it's not one of those solutions that just comes from heaven. Obviously, it does come with a couple of challenges as well. And one of those is the one that you've mentioned, the environmental friendliness of the reagents that we use. But as with any other chemical process, you are going to have waste that will be produced. Now, the sort of like innovative step that, or the innovation that we introduced into our process, was to try and reduce the toxicity of the chemicals that we'd use. Unfortunately, I'm actually not at liberty to disclose what the chemicals exactly were, but I can tell you that compared to the classic method which is in use right now, that is the smelting method, the process that we've developed has got a significant potential to not only increase profits, because it reduces the energy usage, but also to also reduce the toxicity of the entire recovery process as well. So that was the main goal as we were developing the process, to find something that can match the existing process in terms of performance, but at the same time, you know, provide extra benefits in terms of environmental friendliness and sustainability, in terms of profitability, in terms of, you know, reduced costs, in terms of increased recoveries, or at least match the recoveries of the current process. So it is relatively, or it has the potential to be relatively environmentally friendly as compared to the current smelting technologies.
Wow, awesome. And I also spoke to Professor Sehliselo Ndlovu, who was your supervisor on this project. So I have a clip from her, and yeah, she's going to tell us more about the motivation behind the science.
In my research area is hydropetallurgy, so we look at a lot of aspects and deal with a lot of minerals. So we do projects in terms of the minerals that we currently have, working with the mining sector and the mineral companies which process minerals to produce metals. But we also look into the future, where we are saying that the minerals that we currently have, although South Africa is a big country in terms of minerals, mining contributes a lot to our GDP. If you look at where we currently are in terms of the minerals, it's not where we way in the past. We are actually now very much below. We used to be number one in a lot of minerals, especially the PGMs, platinum group metals, and also gold. But we are no longer the leading country in terms of that, which is also telling us that in future, the minerals that we have are not going to be enough to sustain us going forward. And if you look at the fact that we are going into the fourth industrial revolution, which is going to be sustainable only through the metals that we produce, it means that we need to be looking at other alternative sources of metals. And if you look also at where first world countries are going, they are also looking at other alternative sources of metals, because they no longer have metals underground. So for us to remain competitive with all these leading countries, we need not only to be focusing at the minerals that we have underground, but also the minerals that we already have on the surface, which we call urban mining, the minerals that have already been processed, that are sitting in some of the recyclable components, for instance. So one of our focus in our research group is to look at the recycling of metal-bearing components. And Collins had the privilege of looking at the recycling of PGM spent autocatalysts. Because if you look at the autocatalysts that are in our cars, after they are spent, they are discarded, but they still have got PGMs in there. So the idea was to see if we can recover the PGMs from those spent autocatalysts, and at the same time, adding more to supplement what the country is producing in terms of PGMs, and also reducing the impact of this waste material on the environment.
Now, I would imagine that accessing scrap metal for somebody like you, so that you can, you know, actually run a successful business out of it, wouldn't be an easy task. I mean, where would you go about? Would you have to sort of buy the metals? Where would you go to source all of these materials that you need to be working with?
Okay, that's a very valid concern and a very valid risk to the success of the project now as a business outside of the academic sphere of developing, a novel and innovative process. And when we were doing our risk analysis, it is one of, and even in the conversations that we've been having with potential funders and with, potential partners that we've been having, it's one of the things that constantly comes up. And I like that you actually bring it up as well. Because over the period of the past, I would say 6 to 8 months, where I've now been looking at this project outside of the academic sphere and as a business, it's one of the things that I've actually been working on. And one of the things that we have sort of like, developed or that we have identified as a potential to solve this as a risk is to look at the supply of the material from outside of just South Africa alone. So we have learned that the current, sort of like recyclers or the current collectors that are around in South Africa are only collecting from places that are here in South Africa. So we have actually been looking at the region, at the entire Southern African region, to say where exactly can we focus on as a source of material or as a source of scrap catalytic converters. And that's when the advantage of actually me being a Zimbabwean came in, because I managed to penetrate the collection structure in Zimbabwe. I've managed to have a couple of contacts in Zimbabwe. Now we're just looking for a bit of funding so that we can actually start buying some of this material, and in the meantime we can be selling so that we grow our supply structure. Moreover, I have had the opportunity, because of a couple of numerous engagements that I've had and a couple of publications that we've also had, I've had the opportunity of being approached by a certain startup. We're still in negotiations, and we've got a couple of NDAs that we've had that is based in India, and they have been in the business of collecting and selling and exporting their catalytic converters. So now they were interested in using a technology as novel as ours, with the potential for the environmental benefits, with the potential for profitability. They were now interested in partnering with a company like ours so that they could set up a refinery downstream, so that they can also reap the benefits of actually processing their own catalytic converters as well. So you see that in developing a supply structure, we are not only limiting ourselves to just Gauteng or South Africa alone. We are, branching out and looking out for where else we can actually get these catalytic converters, because as you have rightfully said, that is one major risk to the success of the project as a business outside of academia. So those are some of the things that we're actually looking into and doing to try and solve that particular risk.
Wow, that is really interesting what you've just said, because I think it will open up a whole new market that actually didn't exist, and it will enable new players within even business to partake in, exploiting this kind of, field of science, or even in the motoring, in the, the recycling and waste management
industries. Yeah. Yes, that's quite true. That's quite true, yeah. Because the more we interact with other players who are already established, the more it befriends, or the more it strengthens the business case for the project. Again, I have to say this, outside of academia, because it's an entirely different ballgame the moment you step outside of academia.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I was going to actually ask you what are the far-reaching impacts, but you have been mentioning all of these things. There's business, there's a health, there's environmental issues that you are addressing as well. And I'd like to talk about your company, AltMet. I'd reckon it's alternative metals.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, great. I like the name. It is also currently in the process of developing efficiently recovering alumina and titania from Eskom's coal ash, right? And I believe this is also a response to cutting the costs implied in importing and exporting of aluminium and costs of smelting. And you and your team have managed to find this feasible way of extracting these metals from coal ash. So what does this process look like? Because I mean, when you think about coal and the ash, I mean, once the coal is burnt out, I mean, what is there to do with it?
So I'll have to mention that that particular process is still at a very early stage. We've got a proof of concept, of course, but it's still at a very early stage. There's still quite a lot of work that needs to be done on that. But the motivation simply lies in the production of, so coal itself, it contains carbon, which is what would require obviously for producing electricity, but it also comes with a whole lot of other what we call inorganic materials that cannot be burned. So whenever you burn the carbon, you always produce a whole lot of ash. So South African coal, for example, it typically has between 28% and 30% ash. So the rest is carbon, but then about 28% of that material is stuff that you can't actually burn. So you tend to produce, because the energy mix in South Africa is predominantly based on coal technologies. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of this ash product that has been formed. And there have been a couple of projects that have been taken to try and find uses for this particular ash. So I've come across projects where they were using ash in bricks, in refractory bricks. I think there's a couple of companies that are actually doing that. But you realize that Eskom has got a market only for just about 7% of that ash, and there's humongous amounts of this ash that is produced each and every year. So that the motivation there was more, it was more environmental, in as much as it was also for the potential benefits, because South Africa imports quite a whole lot of alumina as well, which is required for the aluminium industry, the local aluminium industries. So you realize that the motivation there is this thing that is being formed, this ash product that is being formed, and that will likely be formed for the next couple of years as far as Eskom is using coal as a source of energy. At the same time, it contains material that is being imported from Australia. I think South Africa's alumina comes from Australia. Can we not look at this particular ash product and develop a process that we can extract value out of it? And like my professor initially said, the motivation is essentially to find value out of what are supposed to be waste products. So that is pretty much the motivation, and this one promises to be a fairly long term project, because there's still quite a lot of work that needs to be done before it starts making economic sense. So there is value in that ash product, and that is what we're trying to look at to see if we can exploit that particular value.
Wow, this is really phenomenal. It's phenomenal work that you're doing. And I think you just gave somebody a business idea as well.
Well, I mean, they can come and talk to me, and then we can have a collaboration.
Sure. Colin is not going anywhere. We are going to go into Unscience, and then thereafter, we'll be back with Collins. So stay right there and stay listening to The Science Inside.
This is The Science Inside.
Welcome back. It's time for Unscience, where we look at the strangest side of research. And this is the part of the show which we all love. And we look at the weird, the wonderful and inspiring things that scientists spend a lot of their money and time and effort on. And today's Unscience was produced by Masibulele, and it is from Live Science. And the music was sourced from No Copyright Sounds on YouTube. So let's get into it.
Unusual, unlikely, Unscience.
All right, let's get into it. So, Bridget, can I ask you a silly question?
Sure, go ahead.
I was going to ask you if you actually have ever seen or heard of black snow. Not the company black snow, but actual literal black snow.
Well, scientifically, it raises a number of questions. I would definitely be intrigued at, and would want to find out what has discolored this snow. However, I would not say that it is likely the end of the world, because the world has plenty of strange things really going on.
Yeah, I'm sure that is exactly what the minds and residents of several towns in Siberia, in the Siberian region of Kuzbass, who actually... it's actually short for Kuznek Basin. So I'm sure that's what they thought right before they actually witnessed their first account of black snow. So a poll of area black snow recently covered the region, which is home to about 2.6 million people. And I must say the pictures look scary. So according to The Guardian, right, several British groups have proposed boycotting Kuzbass coal until the region enacts stronger environmental protections. The simple fact is that there is no way to make coal use environmentally friendly. Even if the black snow is not falling in your part of the world, remember, carbon dioxide released by coal plants remains the leading cause of climate change.
Wow, you make this place to seem like a really legitimate place to film a horror movie. But what do researchers have to say about what is the reason behind this?
Oh, good question, Bridget. So the main reason is that the region is also home to one of the world's largest coal fields.
Ah, I see. Now that is logical. I mean, it must probably be because the smoke and the soot from the burning of the coal, you know, mixes up with with the snow, while, you know, the snowflakes are still falling onto the ground. And then by the time it reaches the ground, we have, you know, pile of black snow.
Well, that is very correct. So according to The Guardian and the Siberian Times, the toxic black coal dust released into the air from open coal pits and improperly maintained factories in the region are the reason for the black snow. One coal plant official told the local media that a shield meant to prevent coal powder from escaping out of the factory and malfunctioned. But toxic black snowfall seems to be quite regular in the area.
So are you saying that this is not the first time that this is actually happening?
Apparently not. So Vladimir Slivek, a member of the non-profit environmental action group Eco Defense, told The Guardian that it is a lot harder to find white snow as opposed to finding black snow during winter. He said there is a lot of coal dust in the air all the time, and when snow falls, what takes place next is clear.
Well, so I'm one of those people who are really concerned about, you know, health implications of things when they do take place. So what are the risks implied and what is being done to counter this?
But now, apparently, what comes to my mind immediately, right, is this question. Of course, if you listen to this, it will blow your mind. Kuzbass is one of the largest coal fields, right, in the world. It spans more than 10,000 square miles, which is 26,000 square kilometers. So you can imagine the sheer size of the place alone. So a 2015 report from Eco Defense found that the citizens of Kuzbass have an average of 3 to 4 year life expectancy. That is shorter than that of their Russian counterparts. It adds that they are nearly twice as likely and twice likely at risk, rather, for contracting TB, in short, and childhood mental disorders.
Yeah, and you know, as I've said before, my concerns are, you know, the health implications. And I mean, people live here and there are children who are likely to play in this place and even eat the snow. What measures are being put in place to deal with this predicament?
You know, I actually have to look beyond these borders and actually see a broader look at other environments where you find these similar coal fields and mines. This is not a story, although it's a foreign story, it's not one that is very far-fetched from our beloved country as well. And like in many parts of the world, this is a sad reality facing many plant workers. The living and working conditions are questionable and unsafe. But the reality is many do not have much of a choice because not much seems to be done. For instance, black snow is a frequent winter feature in this region. Mitigation attempts have been lacking, I quote, and regional authorities were accused of actually masking the toxic black stuff by literally painting over the white pigment, as according to Moscow Times, a report from December 2018.
Wow, that is completely outrageous. You know, I mean, imagine the effort it takes for you to go and color this black snow into white one. I mean, they could just actually just use those efforts into fixing those malfunctioning ducts and, you know, really keeping their people safe. Don't you think?
I actually think so. So I did my small reading because I was wondering who is actually responsible for actually ensuring the safety and the environmental friendliness in this neighborhood. And a document which I found called the Environmental Outlook in Russia from the Federation of American Scientists actually states that Russia has a comprehensive legal and regulatory framework in the environmental area, but government institutions responsible for environmental protection lack the authority and capability to enforce any legislation. So environmental activism has been on the wane since the breakup of the Soviet Union, but I hope that actually answers that. It seems like Russia is in a terrible state governmentally, institutionally.
But I mean, aren't there health bodies or environmental bodies in these countries to hold people accountable? Because this isn't fair.
It is not. I can just imagine being a citizen there and being exposed to all these health risks and nothing is being done. So I agree with you. There should be stricter and more firmer regulatory powers actually enforcing safety. But in this case, it doesn't seem like
it to be the case.
Yeah. So that is the unscience for us this week. I think we can now head to the second part of the show.
Well, as you've said it, we are going to go into the second part of the show with Collins. So just hang tight and we return after the break.
Unusual, unlikely, unscience. Stay curious, stay informed, stay on the Science Inside.
Yes, stay curious indeed. You're still on The Science Inside and I'm your host, Bridget LeBaire. And today, earlier on the show, we had Collins and we have him right back and he's going to talk with us or talk about his journey in the field of science. And we've learned quite a lot from the previous interview or the interview earlier on about what he's been doing in his field of science, where he's actually reusing or actually extracting precious metals from catalytic converters. And now we are in this segment, this part of the show where we get up close and personal and we ask him a bit more about who he is, where does he come from, and all of those things. And I spoke to your professor, Professor Sihlehlelo Ndlovu, and this is what she had to say about you.
Been working with him since 2016 or 15, I can't remember. You know, when I take students, I usually interview them. And for that project, we had about 35 applicants that applied to do that project. And we shortlisted about five. And Collins was one of the person that we shortlisted. And when I interviewed him, he showed a very strong research characteristics or potential to be a strong researcher. And he was very logical in his answers, and I could pick out early on that he actually had a very strong scientific background. And I think I also picked out from some of the work that he had done for his undergraduate, because he also had some work that he did, which he even presented for some stuff on gold tailings, which is another area that I work with. So I could pick out already that he was very strong in terms of research. When he started working here, he was one of the most diligent students that I have actually ever worked with. You know, when students submit their first proposal, usually as a supervisor, you know that most of the stuff that is actually going to be written in the first draft is usually not much to write home about. So you spend a lot of your time guiding them in order to get to the direction of the actual work that has to be done. But the first draft that Collins wrote to me already showed that he understood the topic that he was working on. And his arguments were very clear in terms of where he was going and why he was choosing the process direction that he was choosing. I was very impressed by that. Even during the time when he was doing his work, I think he took a very short time to complete his MSc. And when he did it, it was actually work that was of very high quality, and I was very proud of that. He spent a lot of time in the lab doing most of his experimental work, and sometimes when he didn't understand what he needed to do, he would consult, and we even have arguments in terms of where he wanted to go, and he would motivate in terms of the direction, which to me actually showed me that he owned the project, which is one of the things I try to encourage my students to do. When I give them a project to do, I usually want them to own the project so that they know more than I do by the time they finish. And with Collins, I could tell halfway through that he already was at a higher level in terms of what he wanted to do. So I was very diligent and also wanted to do more than actually what I thought I'd wanted the project to be. In terms of the direction, he ended up going in a different direction from what I'd originally envisioned the project to be. So I could say that he was really a very hardworking person.
Wow, those are really impressive words from Professor Ndlovu there. I mean, that is just, it speaks to your character, the kind of person that you are. And I can tell from, you know, these questions that I've been asking you, and you really well, you know, invested in this project. But as I had mentioned, we want to get to know you a bit more. And I read somewhere that actually you are Zimbabwean born, and you actually mentioned this earlier on in the interview. Can you tell us about your experience? How was it growing up in Zim and transitioning, coming to a whole new country, South Africa? And what has your experience been?
Growing up in Zimbabwe was, there's this narrative that has been written about Zimbabwe out there, so that every time you mention that you're from Zimbabwe, there's this a narrative that people think. But I don't want to stand here and say I had a torrid, difficult time growing up in my country. I think Zimbabwe made me the kind of person that I am. It gave me the drive that I have, and I try to put in everything that I put my mind to. And I think I owe that in great part to Zimbabwe. And when I came, or when I transitioned, when I came down to South Africa for my studies and to pursue my studies, funny enough, the change wasn't as big as I thought it was going to be, because we tend to actually share a lot. There is a lot in common between South Africa and Zimbabwe, but I can definitely say I appreciated the culture that is in South Africa. I think we could copy that a bit and have a bit of that back home as well, because I feel like we've lost our culture a bit. I really loved it when I came to South Africa. That's one of the things that I really appreciated about the country. And moreover, it has given me quite a number of opportunities as well, because what I'm doing here, trying to commercialize my master's, isn't something that I didn't try in Zimbabwe. I did try to commercialize, like Prof was actually alluding to, I did try to commercialize my research in undergrad as well. I did try to form a company out of it. It was in gold, from waste material as well. And we did try to commercialize it, but the opportunities that we got back there were not as good as what we're getting here. The exposure that we got back there is not as much as, you know, South Africa has this culture of, and I've seen it in the universities, it has this culture of trying to nurture innovation, trying to actually put research outputs into the commercial field so that they can solve the real problems that are actually there. So it's just a matter of, do you as the person want to actually do it? And if you want to do it, yes, it's not going to be easy. It's going to be even more difficult given that you're from Zimbabwe. But if you want to do it, there's a whole lot of opportunities, and you can push, and yeah, it can actually, you know, come out. So South Africa, the transition itself wasn't that much different. It wasn't very difficult to get used to South Africa. But I'll say I owe it to both countries. You know, to be where I am at this point in time, which is not much, but it's relatively, you know, comfortable and relatively good.
I will say that it is much. I mean, you're doing really great work. I mean, I'm just totally blown away by what you are doing. I mean, wow. But you're also a wearer of many hats. You're a businessman, you're a student, you've got a personal life to handle as a young person. But how do you handle all of these things? Because I can imagine chemical engineering is not an easy field to be in.
Oh, well, I mean, it's always going to be a challenge, especially, you know, the normal route or the easy route is, you know, get your degree, probably get your master's, look for a job, and that's what would have normally wanted to do. But I felt like I wanted to take the risk and take the so-called route less traveled. And it hasn't been easy. I'm not going to lie to you. It has been quite difficult. But I believe the greatest motivation has been, number one, that innate passion that I've always had for sustainable development, especially the sustainable development as it pertains to Africa. I started blogging about the role of chemical engineering, I think, when I was in my second or third year in university, in my undergrad. I used to write about the role that sustainable development and sustainable engineering has to play in Africa's development per se. So it's that innate passion that I've always had that keeps on pushing me. But more than that, in innate passion or that why of mine, there is always friends around you and the support structure that you tend to build through family, through friends, through even the guys that I'm working with and trying to set up the project, also even through, you know, my work colleagues. That support structure in and of itself is just but humbling. So that tends to, like, you know, make it a bit easier to try and work and take this particular route that I would have chosen. But by no means has it been easy. I'm grateful for it. I like it. I like the challenge. I like the support, and I like the wins. I like the failures when they come as well. They are all learning opportunities.
Sure. And time is fast running out. We are really nearing to the end of our show, but I have the last clip from your professor, and she's speaking about the awards that you attended last year.
I encourage all my students, when they start their project, I try to get them to own the projects that they are doing so that they feel that it is their work. Even though most of the research ideas are mine as the lead supervisor, I give them the research idea, but I encourage them to own the work so that by the time they finish, they should be owning the work, and also to try to do the research, looking at it not just as an academic research, but as something that is marketable, something that they can run with, something that they can make a business out of, even though I know it's a bit difficult. But when they do the research, that's the thinking that they should have in mind, to say, if I do this research, where can I market it? Who can buy this type of work? It's because engineering is all about applications. So you don't want to produce something that just sits on the shelf or a publication without it being used somewhere. So I encourage them to think like that, that whatever the research that they are doing, it should be something that can be sold somewhere to somebody else, or even to develop as a commercial project. I was very, very pleased to see him entering that. I knew that he was going to be able to get some mentoring in terms of how he can develop that further. So we're very proud from our research group here. And I think it also encouraged the others to see that they can be able to do it too. And it's really led to a very changing in mindset for most of the other researchers in our group.
And lastly, I'd like to ask you the last question for the show. It pertains to these awards that you attended in Nairobi last year. So, I mean, how has this competition helped you in honing in on your skills as an entrepreneur and as a chemical engineer?
Uncertain terms, the Africa Prize for Engineering Innovation by the Royal Academy of Engineering has helped me a lot. Like, it's turned me and it's turned my thinking from being strictly academic into, you know, how can you make this a business and that you can actually sell to somebody and produce something that can make a tangible difference. It has given me a whole lot of exposure, opened up a whole lot of conversations, case in point, the Indian conversation I gave you, and a whole lot of other local discussions that I'm also having. Just from the exposure, it gave me seed funding to actually launch the company itself. It has been extremely helpful, and I guess the greatest takeaway from that was, you know, stop thinking just like an academic and start thinking like a business person and how to sell this as a project to the next person.
Wow. That has been very insightful listening to you. I've learned quite a great deal tonight, and I'm really motivated by the kind of person that you are, because I mean, you just, you know, persevering and pushing forward, and please keep up the good work and keep flying both flags, because now we are taking you in on our South African side as well. But thanks a lot to our guests that were featured on our show, Colin Saguru and Professor Sehliselo Ndlovu. And today, the team behind the scenes, production is by Masibulele and tech by Kutlwano Serame. And our podcast can be found on wits.journalism.co.za/science and on iTunes, social media, Facebook and Twitter as VowFM. The Science Inside is produced by the Wits Radio Academy, funded in part by the South African Department of Science and Technology. That's it for this week. Catch you next week, Monday, same time.
The Science Inside, Monday from 6 to 7 p.m. on VowFM 88.1. The Science Inside Podcast.